And from the KTOO newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cremery. Voting is underway in Juneau's local election. The ballot has four questions on it that will affect the future of the capital city. Today, we'll take a look at Propositions 2 and 3. Both ask voters to decide how the city will pay for projects. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
Propositions 2 and 3 look to two of the city's most reliable tools for raising money for infrastructure and projects: debt financing through the sale of municipal bonds, and the renewal of 1% of the local sales tax rate. The bond financing request in Proposition 2 is a smaller ask for parks and recreation projects that are more marginal priorities of the Juneau Assembly. That's part of why Assemblymember Greg Smith supported separating them from the higher priority projects covered in the sales tax question and the standalone question for a new city hall.
By putting it as a bond, it does really give everyone a chance to express their opinion on the projects. And should we take out bonds, should we borrow money to develop them? And then, you know, we will be paying it back with interest. So there's a property tax impact. It's not free. So people have a chance to say, no, we don't want to do that. And that's totally fair.
The impact on property taxes will depend on the terms of the bonds, but city officials forecast it at about $43 a year for a $400,000 home. Most of the money would go toward new turf fields and a track at Adair Kennedy Memorial Park in the Valley. Smith says these are good projects for improving activities for kids and the community's overall quality of life. The ball fields at the park right now are dirt. Smith has firsthand experience.
I remember, you know, playing through standing water and sliding into, you know, mud puddles and stuff. So I think it's just going to improve the safety, improve the quality of play.
Assemblymember Alicia Hughes Scandies agrees they're good projects, but has some reservations about the way the Assembly elevated these lower priority items.
I mean, at the end of the day, you always have limited resources. We're in a great position right now, so our debt capacity is good. So we have things coming off the book, so it's not that this is necessarily going to break the back, but it all adds up.
She says she'll probably vote against the parks measure.
Something like the turf field, you know, that will benefit our kids, so I can't be mad at that. But I can still be a grump about the process.
Proposition 3 asks voters to renew 1% of the city's sales tax rate for 5 more years. It's a temporary tax, but one that voters have renewed every time it's come up, going back to 1972. City officials expect it to generate $60 million. The Juneau Assembly crafted the list of projects the money will go toward through a ranking process with input from city staff and the public. The biggest pot of that money is earmarked for extending the life of existing public infrastructure: schools, police and fire stations, harbors, parks, pools, libraries, heating and ventilation systems, and street maintenance equipment. The rest will be set aside for a grab bag of otherwise unrelated improvements and special projects. If this measure fails, the city's overall 5% sales tax rate will fall to 4% in October of 2023. You can find coverage of other ballot propositions and more resources on our local elections page at ktoo.org. The deadline to vote is Tuesday, October 4th. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And collecting meticulous data during a pandemic can help determine how diseases spread and how to stop them. Reporter Sharon Lafreniere traveled to Alaska for a New York Times investigation that shows how COVID-19 data here and across the nation is lost or unusable due to underinvestment in public health. KTOO's Claire Strumpel spoke with her.
What's the data failure and how did it happen?
We didn't spend money to modernize the state and local health departments. We left them with the spreadsheets, telephones, fax machines, Excel sheets, the old system. I think many people don't understand, and I certainly didn't understand until I got into this, how behind state and local health departments are in data. They're way behind.
You wrote that the low vaccine rate contributed to the heavy death toll in the United States from COVID-19, but so did the lack of data. Why is that deadly?
So, I mean, nobody can pinpoint, we lost XX million, you know, XX number of people, or so many other people, you know, were severely, became severely ill from COVID because we didn't have data. But basically what happened is that the fact that the data pipeline, if you think of the digital pipeline, is totally riddled with holes and obstacles, and it doesn't flow means that the government did not respond as quickly as it could have, because to some degree, you know, they were flying a little bit blind.
What made you come to Alaska to tell this story?
Two reasons. One, Alaska State Health Department is a pretty hard-charging health department, and it has a lot of talented people in it. Secondly, because its problems are quite typical.
What was the atmosphere like when you were here? You know, what did you see? Did anything kind of stand out to you while you were reporting?
People were in on the weekends working on data. They were working on it at night. They were, you know, coming in early, trying to make the data systems work better. I thought that it was a really talented and very dedicated staff, just working on a shoestring, right? A lot of the case reports were coming in over the fax machine, which was on the fifth floor of the health department in the epidemiology section in a corner. And every night it would run out of paper, and they'd have to come in the morning, fill it up with more paper, then carry these stacks of case reports over to a computer to enter them all by hand. So it was a massive effort. It's just like the average health department, they don't have enough resources.
What are the consequences of using trained epidemiology staff to do a bunch of manual data entry? You know, what could they have been doing instead? And what did epi staff in Alaska have to say about this?
So, I mean, that to me was one of the more troubling things, is that if you, think of it like if your phone didn't sync with your computer, right? Then you enter your information in the phone, you got to enter it again in the computer. That's what was happening here. A whole bunch of people had to be roped in to re-enter information because the databases could not connect with each other. So the health department was forced to basically reduce some of its most highly trained epidemiologists for periods of time simply to enter data. And so they would do it on weekends, they would do it at nights, they would start at 6 a.m. in the morning, and that's not unusual. I mean, the disturbing thing about it is people put in all that effort, and then it really, a lot of it didn't come, wasn't useful.
In your reporting, did anyone you spoke to have a sense of how we fix it?
You fix it by money. The government needs to spend, you know, billions of dollars for states and local health departments to upgrade their systems.
Thank you so much for taking time with me.
That was New York Times investigative reporter Sharon Lafreniere talking to KTOO's Claire Strumpel. The state health department sent out its last COVID-19 data summary today via email and social media. It marks a shift from focusing on case counts to tracking broader trends across the state. The department will continue to send its weekly COVID-19 and flu update on Fridays. Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, says those updates will still include COVID-19 case counts.
But we try to put that into a larger context where we also talk about how many people show up in the emergency department for COVID-like illness, how many people are showing up in the emergency department for influenza-like illness, how full are the hospitals in general.
Today's data summary reported 34 hospitalizations and 546 resident cases in the last week. Zink says it's become harder to track case numbers as home tests have become more popular. Those results don't always get reported to the state.
It's become increasingly problematic as we have so many more home testing, and why we need to use it in combination with other data sources to give Alaskans the best sense that they can of kind of the overall transmission and respiratory illnesses in their community at any given time.
Zink says there are important differences between COVID and the flu to keep in mind when it comes to risk level. Older Alaskans are still at the highest risk for severe illness and death due to COVID, while flu carries increased risk for both the very young and the very old.
People should consider getting flu vaccines now, anyone 6 months and older, particularly the young and the old, or honestly people who interact with the young and the old, which is a lot of us.
The bivalent COVID booster, which teaches the immune system to fight both the original COVID strain and the Omicron variant, has been available for about 2 weeks. It's safe to get the booster and the flu vaccine at the same time. Zink says she recommends getting a flu shot by the end of October. And as fall turns to winter, she says taking care of your mental and physical health is extra important. And The nation's first Alaska Native elected to Congress will receive a warm welcome from the state's largest gathering of Alaska Natives this year. The Alaska Federation of Natives will host Representative Mary Paul Tola as its keynote speaker during the AFN convention in Anchorage next month. The convention will take place in Anchorage October 20th through October 22nd. This is KTOO.